The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt podcast, bringing to you the best voices on the stories and issues that matter. Helping make it all possible is the generous partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Here's another piece I'll trust you enjoy.
A privilege to bring back Professor Wilfred Riley. He's a professor of political science at Kentucky State University, author of several books, both hugely important, the ones I'm mentioning right now anyway, Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About. The other one, The Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Selling a Fake Race War. You can follow him on Twitter. It's one of the more active Twitter accounts, entertaining and educational. Will, W-I-L underscore D-A underscore Beast 630. Will DeBeast 630. And his piece, current piece in National Review Magazine, The 1619 False History Project, the cause for which I rang him up today. Professor, Happy New Year, and thanks for being with us.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Glad to be back on the show.
Yeah, you betcha. It's been too long. My fault. I'll make a resolution here to redress that. A lot has been written, a lot has been said, a lot on this show about the 1619 Project. I think the way you broke it down, however, is something new, and you did a really good job in highlighting, if I might, highlighting four critical areas that the 1619 Project really violates and that should be the baseline or the basis for true or good or at least real American history. And I'm wondering if I could run those through with you, if that's the best way to kick it off, or if you wanted to do an overview first.
Yeah, no, you're breaking them down, and
okay.
Us talking about this,
sure.
That sounds good. Sounds fine.
All right, let's do it. The first, the truly that's ignored, and in the 1619 Project, the first thing is the truly global prevalence of slavery and other barbaric practices, as you write. Talk about that. There is no contextualization of this in the 1619 Project.
Yeah, well, what I said about the 1619 Project is that a lot of the things they said about slavery itself, slavery is bad, basically, with a lot more emphasis, aren't necessarily incorrect.
Right.
But this is an odd way to teach history.
Right.
And the analogy that I give is that this would be like teaching about Native American history by focusing your whole curriculum on four Indian defeats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from sort of the Aztecs to Wounded Knee, not talking about any of the Native victories, not talking about the fact that there were Native Americans in this hemisphere before Columbus arrived, not talking about the fact that there are more Indians today than there are in Columbus got here. I mean, Native Americans are a significant political power in much of the west of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that would be a reasonable way to teach about, quote-unquote, the cowboys and the Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And I think 1619 has the same problem. The core of the project discusses these sort of American atrocities and tries to draw conclusions from them. I mean, the claim really explicitly is that what makes America unique is kind of this historical racial conflict 200 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But many other things simply aren't discussed. I mean, you mentioned the most obvious of these, which is that morality in the past was very different from morality in the present.
Mm-hmm.
All adult males are expected to be warriors in most cultures, to give maybe the most obvious example.
Yeah.
But slavery was extraordinarily common almost everywhere in the world until the USA and the Brits in the middle of the 18th century really began to go to task on eliminating it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the ancient Greeks had slaves, the ancient Romans had slaves, the major native tribes like the Aztecs and the Haida had slaves, and so on down the line.
The Arabs had slaves, the Africans had slaves. Yeah. I'm just thinking it through.
The Arab slave trade is actually discussed in some detail in the piece, because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we tend to think of slavery in the context of white people sailing to Africa, the quote-unquote black continent,
right.
And then sailing back to Europe or America with captured, you know, quote-unquote, black bodies. In reality, Africa and the Arab world historically were pretty vibrant compared to much of Europe until quite recently, and were no better morally.
Right.
So there was an Arab slave trade focused on the continent of Africa that began before the white trade, which is called the Atlantic slave trade, and lingered on longer, but overall shipped about 17 million people from Africa to the Arab world. There was also what's called the Barbary slave trade, where North Africans, who can be either black or Arab, sold essentially whites, captured warriors, sailors, and so on, into North Africa.
Right.
That trade sent perhaps 2 to 3 million Caucasians into Africa. So the great races fighting and enslaving each other, taking your prisoners and putting shackles on them across all color lines, this was very, very common. This is why we fought the Barbary pirates
right.
to the shores
right.
of Tripoli.
Right.
So, yeah, all of that, it's odd to talk about slavery and not mention this. If you focus only on whites enslaving blacks and not Arabs enslaving whites and blacks, or occasionally blacks enslaving whites, Egyptians enslaving Jews, if you only look at this one small chunk of the picture, you do get this idea of our country as uniquely evil. And in fact, it was almost mundanely evil. This is something everyone did until we eliminated it.
Nicely put, and I want to circle back to it on another point, but let's get through your list because that's really well done. Second, the detrimental economic impact of what was called the peculiar institution in the American national economy. You do hear every once in a while this story, the economic dependence on it. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, so there are four major problems with 1619, kind of rounding out what you and I started.
Yep.
One is ignoring context.
Yep.
Two is this focus on slavery as kind of the engine of economic
yep.
wealth. And you can proceed on to the others, ignoring the black and white anti-racist movements. On. But this one I thought was pretty interesting
yep.
because this is another argument made without any of what we'd call comparison to alternatives in the academy.
Mm-hmm.
So Nicole Hannah-Jones and her co-authors say, prior to emancipation, a good chunk of the U.S. economy, perhaps between 10 and 20%, was based around slavery. So slavery is what made America wealthy. Now, even leaving beyond the fact that that's an odd description of 20% of the economy, the question isn't, did the black people that were enslaved in the South and the whites alongside them work like everyone else did? It would be incredibly insulting to assume no.
Right.
The question is, in terms of wealth, was slavery something that made the country richer than it otherwise would have been?
Right.
And the answer, obviously, is no. With no offense to black or white Southerners today, the South, until quite recently, was stereotyped as a backwater.
Right.
It was based around these feudal, might be a good term, plantation home estates, which were worked by slaves. So the slave masters got very rich.
Yep.
But the slaves obviously didn't, the offensive term, but quote-unquote poor white trash whose wages were kept down by competition with slavery, they didn't. This is the poorest region of the country. So just to look at, you know, the buccaneers that were in charge of the slave trade and say, well, they got rich, that doesn't mean much of anything. Slavery has always been an economic albatross if you look at Haiti, Russia, Brazil, just countries around the world.
I think that is such an important point. We don't have to get into it, but I often analogize that to places where there is a lot of legalized drug dealing. No, it's not making states rich. It's making those commercial industries rich. We can come back to that another time, whether it works or not. The nuanced but deeply patriotic perspectives here expressed by people of all races on the anti-slavery movement, the anti-slavery ethic in America. I often remind people it was the majority of the country that fought to end slavery. It was the majority of the country that prevailed. The defeated side here was the minority of the country, the minority of the soldiers. Anyway, a lot is being ignored here when we only focus on the part of the slaveholding republic, to use Don Fehrenbacher's words.
Yeah, I mean, so that essentially that's the third point. I mean, going state by state through the four.
Right.
So one of the points, I think that this is actually one of the more coherent and important points in the essay.
Yep.
But essentially, in a sentence, the good guys won.
Yeah.
In American history.
Yeah.
This actually, as a black guy, although not someone incredibly focused on these events 100 or more years before I was born, But as an African American man, obviously I understand that the country has a legacy of racism, just as a male, I understand it has a legacy of sexism.
Sure.
Again, to some extent, this isn't my fault. I didn't abuse women in the past.
I'm not going to hold the problems in the academy against you either. No, you're a professor. Don't worry. Of which there are many. I'm not going to.
No one's responsible for things they did do.
Right.
The point is, we do tend to focus to an incredible degree on this kind of stuff, but the actual trajectory of U.S. history, and of world history, in fact, I think it's fair to say, has been moving dramatically forward toward a better place from a worse one.
Right.
So this point is at its root just very simple. In 1865, the Union broke the Confederacy and won the Civil War, and was by no means kind to the South. I mean, the one-sided narrative of the good guys won even is more ambiguous than you might think. But in 1954, obviously the Union were the good guys.
Yeah.
1954, I mean, we ended segregation in the USA.
Yep.
1967, we passed the Civil Rights Act, making most forms of racism civilly and criminally illegal. Without going to every point of this, I mean, we've had pro-minority affirmative action in the USA since 1967. So I think that the simplest way to put this might be the 1619 Project doesn't mention Frederick Douglass.
Right.
I don't think it mentions Malcolm X. It mentions Martin Luther King briefly and in passing. There's a great deal of focus on sort of obscure Marxist historians,
right,
if you look at the sources, and sort of these traditional slave narratives. I mean, they actually go back to the arrival of the first captured African warriors in Virginia in 1619, that's the year. And I think the reason for this is that if you actually dealt with Douglass or dealt with King, you'd have to acknowledge Booker T. Washington. You'd have to acknowledge the fact that these people liked America.
Yeah.
That there was a great deal of back and forth with and anger about the white compatriots at the time, but that Frederick Douglass was a pretty unabashed patriot.
Oh, I mean,
he was the guy who said, the 4th of July may not be everything you'd imagine it to be to a slave, but he also called the founding fathers great men.
Oh, yeah. Glorious
heroes.
Liberty document was our Constitution. Yes, 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 yes.
Yes, it's right. Everything that needs to be in that priceless compact is in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Frederick Douglass was probably more enthusiastic about the USA than many people today, sometimes
Agreed.
Including me.
Agreed.
I mean, so, but dealing with this, actually saying, obviously, Mr. Douglass recognized the problems in the country, but at the same time, he thought the Founding Fathers were one of the greatest groups of men that had ever assembled. You get the feeling he was profoundly glad not to be living in the Africa of the
right.
time.
Yeah. Yeah.
All of those things, and there's actually a long tradition of that in black literature. Keith Richburg wrote a book called Out of Africa.
Oh, yes, the Washington Post reporter. Yes, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
But
yes.
I recommend people read it.
Yep.
And again, I think many Americans who come from, say, Bosnia or Northern Ireland or Mexico, by the way, could write a similar volume.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes back home to what's essentially, first he starts out in Kenya, I believe. He goes to Nigeria, which is where most black American ancestors come from. He's a great reporter, so he winds up in Rwanda during the war. And, I mean, his description is that this place and most of the world are dull, primitive hellholes compared to D.C., to a major American city.
Basically, he says, whatever the reasons, however the means, thank God I'm American, basically.
Yeah, there's a really funny, essentially, I mean, we're both people that have had a drink at a hotel with a bar, and there's a funny passage where he talks about, you know, he goes to Goree Island, where the slaves had been shipped from, and there are people crying, and these business women writing inscriptions in the book, like, all whites understand is the gun. And his thought is, well, I just left the wars in Africa. I'm glad to be going back to the USA.
Yeah.
So he says that had he come from the other side, had he visited Goree first, there probably would have been months of this lingering anti-patriotism. But he came from, as it were, the right direction.
Yeah.
He's going back home as a black American. Yes. He's got tickets on United.
Yes.
So, there's a poignancy to that. And you can picture many Americans confronting, you know, the Yugoslav highlands in the same way, some of El Salvador. But, anywho, so the point three is essentially just the 1619 Project authors, unlike Frederick Douglass and Martin Luther King, don't seem to like the country very much.
Yep.
So they don't mention this heroic movement that won.
Yep.
The defeat of, to the extent it's mentioned at all, the defeat of the Confederates, the defeat of white racism is attributed to who, sort of the reactionary wing of the black community, I think it's fair to say, or revolutionary wing of the black community, That's a separate question. I don't think that's true to any real extent. You made it.
But there is an almost weird. But there is an eerie or weird, almost new lost cause movement to be found here, right? As there is something to an odd fascination with the fact that the South didn't lose.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. A black female friend who's an academic but also a veteran, generally votes Republican, she said this on my Twitter and Facebook page, in fact, that a lot of the stuff that you see from 1619 or Howard Zinn just seems like recycled Confederate
propaganda.
Yeah.
That is the history of America. It is the Confederate history of America they read. It's what Jefferson Davis and Alexander Stevens said our founding was, as opposed to Martin Luther King or Frederick Douglass or Ulysses S. Grant. Oh, there's no question in my mind that the history they are writing is the Confederate history of America. There's no question.
It's a fascinating. I'm a political scientist more than a historian, so I mean, someone else would have to dig into these texts. But it'd be fascinating to see a right-leaning historian look at this. I mean, are a lot of these ideas, like, for example, that the South was very well-fed and had a higher income than the North, which strike me as ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But do those come from, say, slave master narratives? Have we reached the ultimate in absurdity? And politics being what it is, I wouldn't be surprised at all.
No. That's right.
But at any rate, so in reality, those of us who come from the North cheered for the Union. I mean, understand that the good guys won. That's point three. And point four is just, I'm speaking here as a black man, as someone who very much likes the diverse modern America, within reason, re-immigration and so on. But I mean, speaking as someone who's fond of this, it's just idiotic to say that historical black slavery or historical race war between blacks, whites, and natives is the reason for all American uniqueness.
Right.
So I just list a couple of different things, like Irish immigration.
Right.
You know, I mean, NASA, everyone working together to go to the moon. You know, the growth of the California economy with the Japanese farmers. There's an element of what are you talking about here?
Yep.
But it's very rare, I think, that this is challenged because it's so incredibly woke. It's black and it's feminist and it's from the Times and so on. It's a Pulitzer Prize-winning project. But a lot of it just seems like nonsense. It would be hard to publish. It would be hard for one of my students to publish a book report saying everything unique in America was invented by black people.
Right.
But we're now at a point where this is tolerated in the public space, and that's kind of problematic.
My last question is the attempt here to kind of make America a down market commodity? Is it part of a re-racialization of society, or is one kind of in service of the other?
I think it's an interesting question. So there are, generally, when you see a major trend, there are multiple forces at work. I wouldn't be surprised if the woke movement, to some significant extent, was funded by overseas opponents, actually.
I get it. I get it.
I mean, I was in the business world for quite a while, did pretty well. I mean, when you think about the amount of money the Chinese and the Arabs have invested in the U.S. economy, why not throw a few bucks in that direction? That's interesting, actually, as a counterpoint to the endless allegations, you know, based or not, that the Russians are helping out the political right. So the world's a big place. But I think within the minds of the people that are doing this, there's a weird phenomenology going on. So my personal honest opinion is that for decades, white liberals said ridiculous things to kind of boost their own bona fide.
Sure.
Like, I mean, we've all read Radical Chic, where the people are talking about the Black Panthers and women's, you know, intimate liberation, let's say, and, you know, we're going to do this and that on the street corners. I don't think that these first generations of white radicals, Judith Butler and so on, knew that people were listening. That the people in the increasingly integrated urban schools where they were teaching were hearing their words and not understanding them as posturing. So I think Nicole Hannah-Jones really does believe that black people invented almost everything in America.
Yeah.
I get this often from young, woke friends as the population demographic shifts. The question is, the question to some extent is, why are people propping this up?
Yeah.
Because I don't think Kent Schulzberger at the New York Times believes that.
Right.
And at some point, the longer this goes on, the harder it's going to be for people to stand up and say, all of this is nonsense.
Yeah.
And this is before we even get into the gender issue and so on.
Yeah.
But at some point, that is going to have to happen.
Professor Riley, but for the time I could speak to you for hours, you are a great teacher, and I appreciate your time with us. I really do. God bless you, sir.
Well, thanks a lot. You as well.
Thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you're enjoying the podcast, please tell a friend to go to Town Hall Review and sign up as well today.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.